Radio Freethinker, episode 72. Hello and welcome to Radio Freethinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your freethinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver.
And this is Don, your philosopher political science guy.
And this is Rob, cognitive psychologist and sunburn haver.
And we also have a few extra special people in the studio today.
Hi, this is Jacob. I've been on once before, and I'm here to talk about a recent event at SFU. It's great.
But before we get to that, Jacob, how do you say your last name?
Lillian Wall.
For those of you who can only listen, spell your last name for us.
It's Liljenwall.
So as you can see, folks, I can be excused for mixing it up the first time he was on the show. Isn't that right, Jacob?
Yeah, any normal human being who isn't Swedish can be excused for pronouncing my last name incorrectly for basically an indefinite period of time.
Okay. So if you happen to be Swedish and you mispronounce the name, it's like, what, off of the arms?
Actually, Swedes, I really mispronounce it, because Swedes would probably say Lillian Wall.
Hmm. Well, fortunately, there are no Swedes on this show. Now, let's get on to Radio Freethinker here, and Jacob's here for a very important reason. The SFU skeptics have a banner, which has been vandalized, again, coincidentally. Now, what does this banner say?
The banner has what we call the bus slogan, there is probably no God, so stop worrying and enjoy your life, which is currently sort of overseen in Canada by Freethought Association of Canada, I think, if it was going to be on buses. But we just did it for our campus. We got a vinyl banner printed up, and it's had sort of a checkered past. The first thing that happened was a print shop employee in charge of installing the grommets on it wouldn't do it. But that was okay. We did it ourselves. The other people at the shop were perfectly nice. It wasn't an issue. And then when we put it up the first time, it was held up with ropes, and someone cut the ropes and sort of, like, crumpled it up and put it by where we'd had it hung up. So it was very half-hearted, and we were a little confused by it because it was like, you know, they had to have a sharp object in their hand in order to do this, but they didn't use it on the banner itself, just, like, deinstalled it.
So they were lazy vandals.
Well, actually, maybe they were worried that they'd actually be charged with a crime if they actually broke the sign, whereas cutting the rope somehow just doesn't seem to be as criminal as it would have been to have slashed it.
Yeah, it could be something like that. I really can't. My armchair psychology is not strong enough to figure out what that first incident meant. But then recently, last week, we had it installed in a glass display case in Convocation Mall, and someone put paint over basically the part of it that says no God. So it, in essence, would have read while it was still in the case, there is probably no splotch. Just a big splotch of like vinyl sort of house paint over the glass. And again, the banner is weirdly unscathed. Like they painted over the outside of this plexiglass case it was in. So the case, which is FSFSS property, is painted on, and they have to like unmount it and go get it cleaned to replace the glass. I'm not sure which. And it costs the club nothing. It's the banner is ready to be put back up as soon as we feel like it. And the whole thing is just like weirdly pointless. It so doesn't target the skeptics as a club that I'm sort of mystified as to whether they're timid or just inept or so what.
If the Vandals are listening, you are cowardly and incompetent.
Well, what do you guys normally do with this banner? I take it that you just put it up wherever you feel like it.
Yeah, we just display it. We've mostly been displaying it in Convo Mall. The banner, incidentally, was paid for with a grant from the Simon Fraser Student Society. It was printed at our print shop at SFU, and it's installed. It's displayed free of charge for us because we're a campus club. Basically, wherever on campus there's a place to put it. So it's... it's very much like the. In case there's any question as to whether we are allowed to do this, whether this is a gray area at all, it's not. We are, and so the vandalism is a little weird. Now, to George Parker's credit, and actually, I think last time I was on here, I misstated this. George thought that something like this was going to happen from day one. He was actually the only person. Sort of Cassandra-like saying, we're going to have this kind of response. And everyone else was like, no, it's Canada. We'll be fine. Well,
did you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, we're still fine, come to find out. But it's not as fine as we thought we'd be. And the one thing about this that is a little bit troubling is what I was told by the SFSS when I spoke to them about this. And their suggestion was this, that they had been saying for some time... this was the first I heard of it, but they said they'd been saying for some time that they would like us to take the banner down each night and put it up again each morning. So I'm wondering mostly, the biggest question to me is if this had been a Campus for Christ banner or a Muslim Student Association banner, would that be what they were told?
Have there been a history of vandalism of other banners or student organizations?
Not that I know of.
What is the typical way that, suppose you're walking around SFU and you see a banner that you just think is terribly offensive, you horrible bad taste, it's completely inappropriate, how do you normally, legally, respond to that? Is there a complaints department? How do people respond to something like that?
The most sensible thing would probably be to take a complaint to the Student Society, to the SFSS. Their name is on it. Their general office is quite nearby where the banner is displayed. But the SFU skeptics have also tried to be very easy to contact. So I believe our actual website is on there, and it's easy to get in touch with us through that. So it's not as if we're unreachable if someone had a real problem. It's not as if we wouldn't listen either. After the fallout of Draw Muhammad Day, I wrote a whole editorial specifically, telling people not only is there an email address at the bottom of this where you can contact us, we will hold an event to talk about this if you want. No response.
Maybe you're going about this the wrong way. I mean, one, it doesn't seem to be an organized group. This might just be a lone individual who is a bit more radical, perhaps, than your average individual.
Or just some guy who's, trying to screw with you for fun. I mean, he might not even care.
Oh, yeah.
You're just an easy target.
Well, no, I think it's directed at you. But I mean, have you thought of, camping out and just keeping a subversive eye? It's a little radical. But from the timeline, I think from the first event to the second event, there was a bit of time that it was up. But whoever's doing this is like, oh, crap, they've got that back up. I'm going to go get some paint, and I'm going to attack it that way this time.
Yeah, there was a really long delay between these two incidents, so I feel like they might have been separate people, actually. Or just one person who kept seeing it day after day. We had it installed in the same place for a long time and sort of got more and more either tempted or offended by it. I guess what worries me is that in the event it is someone who's really made angry by this, that they feel they have no other outlet? That's what sort of bugs me about this, because perhaps there are other people who are, where it sort of ruins their day to see this or whatever, and they don't they aren't inclined to talk to anyone about it. They just sort of get mad, and then maybe one person like that decides to throw paint on the thing.
In the message, too, I mean, it's a very compatibilist-type message, right? I mean, it's not like we hope your God burns in hell or anyone who believes in God is a stupid person. It's very just sort of like for atheists or agnostics out there saying, hey, you're not alone kind of message, right? So, I mean...
Yeah, the primary purpose of this, as I saw it, was to be a message to students on campus who are secular and who often have told us that they do feel unwelcome when they see all of these religious clubs out during club days and no representation for themselves. This is mostly directed at them. This is my thinking about it, at least, to say, you know, here's an organization on campus that is for people like you. It's not really... going to win any religious people over, I don't think, nor should it make them very angry, really.
Out of curiosity, is this an issue on the SFU campus? I mean, like, you're here talking to us. Is the SFU has its own paper, right, and such?
Peak.
So, I mean, like, is this becoming an issue of free speech or just violence on campus, or is this just you guys saying, damn?
No one's threatening to censor us. We've gotten a few angry articles in the Peak about various things, including, I believe, the banner once.
No, I mean the opposite. I mean, people who are upset about the vandalism happening to your banner. I mean, as you pointed out, if someone had done this to a Christ for Life or whatever group, I'm quite sure there would be some saying, oh, look at the intolerance in our society and all that. Have you guys generated any kind of that kind of pushback to what seems to be someone trying to, you know, attack you guys or
no.
your message?
Our outrage machine is not as strong, and I don't know that we really want it to be. I am going to call attention to this difference, though, that were this, if it was a Hillel banner or some sort of pro-Palestine banner, I mean, there would be huge implications. The fact that it's us, everyone's just kind of like, eh.
That's interesting. Well, keep us apprised of SFU banner updates in the future, Jacob.
Can I call it Bannergate?
You may not.
Damn.
If anyone has any comments about that story, please write in at radio.freethinker@gmail.com.
Well, there's another problem for another group out there, and that is 9/11 truthers. They may have to deal with something very strange for their conspiracy theories. It turns out that an 18th century wooden ship has been discovered buried at Ground Zero in New York City.
So you mean the 9/11 attack wasn't the second attack on the Twin Towers, but the third one?
They tried to crash a boat into it?
Maybe. 100 or so years ago. Well, what's interesting about this is, you know, they're working away, building, I guess, new stuff there, and they come across a 30-foot-long boat. And it's been buried there since the 18th century, and 20 feet under street level.
You know what? One of the things I found really striking was that this boat was sunk in water. It might have been shallow, but it was sunk in water. Mm-hmm. And if you take a look at where the Twin Towers are, I mean, it's several blocks inland from the current coast. Just how much that island has grown in like 300 years.
Well, see, that's exactly the point, because this was a process that they would use to extend the land, essentially. Back when the river was much closer to the area, they would sink ships and other debris and use it to build land on. That's exactly what they were doing in this case. And it's not actually the first boat to be discovered in New York. Not too long ago, in 1982, they found an 18th century cargo ship, which was actually like a couple blocks away. So it's a pretty common occurrence. Common. It's reasonably not rare. And it's actually quite exciting for the archaeologists involved, and they're working as fast as they can to get it out of there. After all, it's been buried for so long, it's going to start to decompose once exposed to air. They found things like cannons and shoes and anchors nearby, which is quite an interesting find, and hopefully they can learn something very fascinating about old sailing boats that were sunk in New York City.
Now, again, just because this is our show, so they're not saying that this is proof that there's alien technology, because it was really beyond the technology of 18th century people to lift a boat out of the water this far and plant it there and then preserve it in such a... Yeah, we should move on.
Yeah.
From my understanding, they found this when they were excavating the site for the Ground Zero Memorial, and presumably that construction has... come to a halt while they excavate this find. So what did the people concerned with getting the memorial up at Ground Zero think of this? Are they...
Well, considering that it's been how many years since they started working on this memorial?
It's like, well, since right after 9/11, they started talking about it. But there's a lot of complex issues with regards to jurisdiction, because the Port Authority owns the land, but someone rents the land, and the insurance companies kind of bought the land. And so that's why it's been taking them like forever to fill out that part, let alone get everyone else who died in the, well, not the ones who died, but the family relatives of the people who died in it, as to what should be done as a memorial for this. It's a really common, that's why it's been dragging on for well over a decade, pretty much, soon to be.
Interesting enough, the archaeological team was hired by the group that's excavating the area because they were finding all these like weird old things buried underground. And they were like, hey, look at this. It's an old shoe, and this is an old bike or something. And they needed trained people to get them out of there and not, you know, wreck them. So, cool. Very interesting find in New York City. Well, let's take a commercial break, and we'll be back with more on Radio Free Thinker.
Why, sometimes I'd like to take a peppermint and a switchblade and a Cadillac and throw it all in a fire.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Radio for crazy people and the elderly. Oh, yeah.
CITR has more friends than ever before. We've partnered with tons of local businesses to bring you great discounts in the communities where you live, work, and play. Maybe Main Street is your main drag. Present your Friends of CITR card at Red Cat Records, Lucky's Comics, Devil May Wear, Thriller, Blim, The Kiss Store, The Wallflower Modern Diner, RX Comics, Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Vinyl Records, Regional Assembly of Text, and Twig and Hottie to receive fabulous discounts. So become a CITR member, get a free Friends card, and feel the love.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So, it's really hot today.
Yes, it is.
Is it the hottest day of all time?
Well, I can't say it's the hottest day of all time. But I was so inspired when Fox News, when they had the snowstorm in January, I think it was, in Washington, saying, look at global warming, it's a total farce. Look at the snow out there. And yet, you know, they haven't come on the air and say, you know, this is the hottest heat wave we've ever had, and global warming might be true. But I was reading an article, actually, from NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, it's an American one, so they say nationally mean that, was talking about how 2010 is on track to be the hottest year in record. That the first 6 months have been the hottest since 2007. That the hottest year, which is what it's aiming for, has been 2005. That Russia is in the middle of a drought that's been like the worst one in 130 years.
Hold on a second here. If this is the hottest year on record, I distinctly recall last year being hotter right now than this year is. So I think this whole thing is just complete bunk.
Well, of course, that goes to the whole idea, the difference between weather and climate. So as I say...
Oh, I see.
So the first 6 months is an average thing. And actually, there's some interesting things that came out when I was reading this. First of all, it said the hottest year since 1880. And being stupid, the first thing that came to my mind was like, oh, so 1880 must have been a really hot year. But no, it just says since 1880 because that's when this particular data set was started. So there were no temperatures beforehand. And actually, if you look at temperatures, it was quite cold that year. They also say that some areas are going to be warmer, Peru, Eastern United States, East and West Asia, which somehow strikes me as all of Asia, but
not the middle bit.
Yeah, well, and some parts are actually going to be colder. So Scandinavia, South China, the Northwest United States. So you know, Ethan, when you said it was hotter last year this year, that actually kind of goes with what the climate models are saying, which is why everyone's trying to get away from the term global warming versus climate change, because depending on where you are, the climate will change, but it won't necessarily be hotter for you, even though everyone overall will get warmer.
I remember a couple weeks ago there was an article in the Vancouver Sun talking about beating various temperature records, and I think in Abbotsford, sort of closer inland, it was hotter than it had ever been before, but not here on the coast in Vancouver. The hottest was like 34, 35 degrees, and we've only reached 31 or so.
I just got back from Las Vegas, where I was attending the amazing meeting, which is the big skeptical conference that James Randi and the JREF put on.
That's amazing.
It is amazing. Coincidentally, while I was there, I interviewed Joe Nickel, who you will hear from later in the show. But getting back to what you were saying, Don, I just wanted to say that I was at TAM.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to make a comment about, like, in, it was hotter in Vegas.
Yeah, it's worth mentioning that while global temperatures will rise on average, and some places will be hotter and some places will be colder, Vegas will continue to be hell on Earth.
Yeah.
Oh, we just lost all our Vegas listeners. Sorry about that, folks. Anyhow, remember, he's Swedish, so. But a few other interesting things come about this. Like, apparently this is the 304th consecutive month of warmer temperatures, warmer than the average temperature of the 20th century. So the average temperature of the 20th century, which I must admit I don't know off the top of my head, was, let's say, 50 degrees. 340 months ago, the last 304 months have been hotter than that. Okay, so that being said, another aspect to this which I thought was interesting was we had the Copenhagen UN Climate Conference in 2009, and one of the things they wanted to do is set some targets, whatever, to try and keep the average temperature below 2 degrees increased by, I think it's the end of the century, but it might have been 2050. I tried to look that up, and I couldn't find firm numbers on that one or the other.
I recall, the results of the talks were rather disappointing there.
They were, but the 2 degrees I thought was interesting, because when I was doing research for this, the average land surface temperature for June was over 1 degree higher than the average for the 20th century. So 10 years into this decade, we're already at 1 degree higher. Everything looks like it's going to be much more than that. And they were saying, oh, we'd be lucky to keep, we should only aim for 2 degrees, and that's going to be good enough. And it looks like we got not a hope in heck of doing that. So we're all going to burn to death. Life sucks.
Or freeze, depending on where we are.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, that's a whole other thing about the mid-Atlantic current, but I won't go into that side one. Another weird thing that I discovered when I was doing research, and again, this is just things that made me scratch my head, is, as I mentioned before, that Russia is in the midst of one of its longest droughts in history, and it's being hit with really, really hot temperatures for them. It's like 35, 38 degrees. They expected to hit above 40 degrees temperature in parts of Russia, and lots of people are trying to cool down. And this is really big in the news. If you look up Russia and heat wave, almost all the articles show how many people have died from drowning. And you go, oh, well, okay, people try to keep cool, so they're going to go in the water.
Like, there's like, you know, hundreds of Russians die from while drowning trying to escape the heat. And exactly. That's horrible.
And then you look at the story, and every one of them says, because they're all drunk. Vodka. Everywhere is vodka. It was so bizarre to see this. If you read this, you would be convinced that everyone in Russia is A, hot, B, in the water, and pissed to the gills. No one else drinks and drives in the boats. I mean, it's actually an incident in Okanagan, I think.
You were about to say Manitoba.
Yeah. Well, I was in Manitoba when I heard about this, where someone was drunk and they ran into a houseboat, right? So, I mean, but this is just the way the news spun.
You can't just pass by that offhand. How did they run into a houseboat?
Well, there was a boating accident, and I think it was okay,
in another boat.
Yeah, so one boat, speedboat, was speeding along, and I believe the guy was intoxicated, although, again, I haven't followed this story.
Was he rushing?
Rammed into it. Well, you know,
was he really
judging, judging from the news articles. But my biggest point is here the world's experiencing a really tangible example of climate change, and what is the press doing? It's talking about drunk Russians. I mean, really, is that where the story is here?
Yeah. Well, do you happen to remember if the number of drowning deaths is big compared to drowning deaths in Russia in the past, or drowning deaths anywhere else? Or
well, that would be context, and news don't like context. The only number I got was, and this was a big banner, 71 people died in one day. 230 died in 1 week. Different stories, different numbers they were using. Which I admit, sounds like a lot, but then Russia's a big country, and I mean, that might actually only lead to 1 in a million people dying. Well,
I have no point of reference for this. I'm wondering, like, how many people in Canada drown every day or week, or, you know, the United States or China, or really anywhere would probably help give me some frame of reference.
Something to look up on Stats Canada.
And you know, actually, that is such an important thing. The context of a discussion, and again, the reason why I didn't get that particular information, because it seemed tangential to the actual articles itself.
Interesting.
Yes.
So the takeaway from this is that if you're really warm because of global warming, don't drink vodka and go swimming.
Right. Beer.
And also that the media and most people don't really care or and they can't do anything about global climate change.
You know, this is kind of perhaps beating a dead horse, but you know all those like Molson Canadian commercials where people like drinking beer and then like jumping off cliffs into the water?
Yes.
That doesn't seem very safe.
Or what about the Budweiser and the pool commercials? I mean, obviously those weren't done in Moscow because, you know, you just have dead bodies in the pool.
I bet all of them end, please drink responsibly, though.
Yeah.
Yes, they do. It's kind of like heroin addict, right?
Not to get off topic, but a friend of mine was saying that someone should market a bottle of branded alcohol named responsibly, so all alcohol ads would be an advertisement for you.
Interesting. Well, let's take a commercial break on Radio Free Thinker. When we come back, we will have an interview with the paranormal investigator, Joe Nickel.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
The state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now, hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a crowd. I draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
Uh-huh. You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Bread and Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver. CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
Welcome, listeners, to Radio Free Thinker at TAM, the amazing meeting in Las Vegas. This is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, and I'm here with author, investigator, and contributor to Skeptical Inquirer, Joe Nickel. Joe, welcome to Radio Free Thinker.
Thanks for having me.
So, you are a paranormal investigator. That sounds like a fantastic job. Where do I apply?
Well, you have to be a self-starter like me. There really isn't a place that offers a course in it very much, though now I guess we have some workshops and things, but it's a world where you can just be a self-starter, but you do need to have a science-based attitude, and because there are lots of so-called paranormal investigators. I'm almost ashamed to use that term now, because what it means in so many quarters is it means some silly people who are using glitch-prone equipment that they've maybe bought from a local store. Electromagnetic field meters or something, Geiger counters even.
Mm-hmm.
And they think they're detecting ghosts, and they call themselves paranormal investigators. They're not investigators at all. They have a dogma, they have a belief in ghosts, and they're trying to find ways to prove that ghosts exist. This is not the scientific approach.
Right.
They are starting with the answer and working backwards to the evidence and using equipment that was not made to detect ghosts, and in fact does not detect ghosts. And so what one should be doing is going to haunted places and saying, now what's supposed to be happening here, and trying to figure that out.
Right.
Using whatever tools are useful. I've used all kinds of things, from forensic science to psychology to, you know, just my own alertness to catch a prankster tricking a ghost.
So what motivated you to investigate these claims and stories? Was there when you were young, were you really interested in the occult and stories and ghosts and UFOs?
Well, what kid at some point isn't interested in magic and the occult? Sure, and then you figure out that some of it's not real, and then you get a little older and you think, well, are some things that are being claimed, and I don't know what's going on, and so on. I was a kid, I was interested in such things, and I also knew that I was, by the age of 8, I knew I was a detective. I was quite sure that I was a detective. And I got away from that off and on over the years, so I became a detective. and a lot of other childhood things, like being a magician. And I had a collection of all my collections, like rocks and minerals and fossils and coins and antiquities and so forth. I had a museum in my home, and so I later worked as a museologist.
Excellent.
I've had a lot of jobs, and I've spent my life pretty much seeing how many different things I could do and be. So, but I sort of grew up to do the things as a child that I had wanted to do and be. The interesting thing, a lot of people don't do that. They have fantasies in their childhood, and then they grow up, go to college, and do something, you know, sensible or not or whatever, and mm-hmm. they're not necessarily in keeping with the child in them. But I managed to do some of both.
Awesome.
And so I began. I found myself in Canada right after college and after a year as a VISTA volunteer. But the war in Vietnam was looming over the horizon, and they were out to get me for induction. And I was morally opposed to the war in Vietnam, but not a conscientious objector, just opposed to that war. Mm-hmm. And I had marched with Martin Luther King and been heavily involved in the civil rights movement, and King was anti-war. And so I fled with my new wife to Canada, and we and then became, for the next 8.5 years, I became a federal fugitive, wanted by the FBI. And that's when I needed to find myself. My life was very disrupted and in turmoil. My wife and I split shortly thereafter. And so I threw myself into my childhood hobby of magic. Saved me. And from that, I got interested again in Houdini, and Houdini's going after spiritualists and things, and became a magician at the Houdini, and met James Randi, and thought, wow, isn't this great what he does? And so I would pester him when he would come to the museum, you know, every 6 months or a year or something. I'd see Randi, you know, I'm sure I was quite a pest. And then I decided to go and start investigating, and I did my first investigations, and thought that went very well, and I decided I'd better become a detective so I would know how to investigate better, and I did that, and I've been doing different things ever since.
So you investigate ghost claims, and is it just the supernatural, or do you investigate more maybe mainstream, like miracles, religious things? Like, for example, have you ever examined the crackers at a Catholic ceremony to see if they undergo any transformations?
No, I haven't done that, but I have certainly been to healing ceremonies in different places, including Catholic Church and other places. Some Catholic charismatics do healings, and I have a picture of me undergoing healing. I've actually, the guy just pushes you, and you just about have to fall backwards. But I wrote my first book on the Shroud of Turin. I've examined more weeping icons and such things than maybe anybody. I have shaken the bloody hand of stigmatists. I looked at glowing statues and other miraculous phenomena at a number of sites, Conyers, Georgia. I've exposed, you know, the statues at Conyers that had statues people thought had heartbeats. They did not. I took a stethoscope. They simply were, the pilgrims were simply reaching up and feeling the statue, and I think just feeling the pulse in their own hand, and thought it was a heartbeat. So I've done things like that, replicating so-called miracle photographs, making them myself under test conditions. And I've talked about these things on Discovery Channel and National Geographic and other sites. And I investigate miraculous phenomena extensively, and also pretty much everything else, all the paranormal, Bigfoot, other monsters, crop circles, psychic phenomena, spiritualists. I have caught pranksters and exposed fake spiritualists got police warrants. But I like any kind of mystery, and I have this other avocation that not as many people know about, where I authenticate or not rare historical documents.
That's fascinating.
Among those, I've done for Time Warner, for example, not a small company, the Jack the Ripper diary and the Bondwoman's narrative.
Interesting.
The Ripper diary was fake, the Bondwoman's narrative authentic, though not necessarily written by a slave as it purports to be, but might have been written by, say, an abolitionist writer adopting the persona of an escaped slave, which is maybe more likely. But I've investigated homicides. During my period as a private detective, I worked undercover and infiltrated theft gangs, bodyguarded politicians, did fixed and moving surveillance, stakeouts, you know. So really, I have to say, I don't much care what the nature of the mystery is. If it's a good mystery...
You're into it.
I'm into it. I've done a lot of historical investigation, and when I went back late in life to get my doctorate, and I went back to English literature, which seems very inappropriate for a paranormal investigator, but I focused on literary investigation and folklore, which have been immensely helpful to me. And literary investigation is, I like that just as much. Just to give you one example, I worked on the case of the lost edition of the early American satire, The Sotweed Factor. We have the first edition and many copies, and we have many copies of the third edition. No one has ever found a single copy of the lost edition of The Sotweed Factor, and it's considered, you know, one of the great mysteries of early colonial literature and so forth. As a graduate student, I found it. It was on the shelf all the time under a different name, and it's an interesting story, but and I had very sound proof, and no one's questioned the proof. I've published now that in books and articles and so forth, and worked on many other literary mysteries. So, in other words, I don't let you bring me a mystery, and I'm not a scientist per se, an amateur scientist surely, and have some scientific background, but if I need a scientist, I do just as a homicide detective does. A homicide detective is not a scientist. He brings in forensic people and pathologists and so forth. He's a detective. He's trying to put all this together and solve a mystery. The scientists are not necessarily tasked with solving a mystery. They're tasked with comparing that bullet with this test fire and make a report. That may in fact solve the mystery, or it may deepen it. But they're doing their job. They're solving at a certain level. But the sort of holistic work, if you will, of the detective work is the case of a police commander, usually with a rank of lieutenant or so, who's hopefully, and I've met some, they're just good detectives, kind of like me, probably born a detective at the age of 8.
Excellent. I would imagine that you have an added issue to deal with, and that is when you're investigating a miracle, people get really emotionally invested.
They do.
And it must be difficult at times to tell people that they're wrong. And I imagine they might get very angry sometimes, or they might get very depressed. Is that difficult for you?
Well, you hope for the best. I think probably the worst offenders are maybe the UFO people. I don't know what it is, but that's mostly a male phenomenon, and there are probably more cranks and crackpots in that field, though I certainly don't mean that they all are, or even most of them, or anything, but I've had death threats and just, you know, just anger at a kind of hysterical level. The people who deal with miracles are more apt to write you a letter telling you how sorry they feel for you. And how, you know, Jesus will forgive you if only you turn, you know, or they'll pray for you or something. They're not the death threats, usually.
Right.
Give you one example of how this can work out. See, I don't think we need a paternalistic attitude towards people. Like, well, the little people need something to believe in. Or the little people need you to protect them from themselves or something or whatever. My job is to investigate, find out the truth. This is not easy. Find out the truth as best you can, and then tell it. And then people have to decide whether it's for them or not, and so on. But I was leaving work one day, and it was a Friday, I remember, and I was looking forward to the weekend, and somebody stopped me on the way out and said, did you see the story about the glowing statues at Campbell, Ohio? And I stopped dead in my tracks, and I said, find me everything, get everything off the internet that you can find me on that, print it out now, before you leave for the day. And I turned around, went back to my office, and started packing my investigative kit for things I thought I might need. And I did not have everything, because I didn't really know the story. And by early the next morning, I was off from Buffalo on the road to Campbell, Ohio. And I get there, and then, of course, pretty quickly I could see this. The statue's way up on a bell tower, but I can see that it's not glowing at all. It's shining. The gold leaf on the statue is shining in the sun. But somebody says, oh, well, Mr. Skeptic, you know, it glows at night as well.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well. So I was there for some time. I talked to the priest, and he and the bishop were with me. There was no problem. We were in agreement. I was maybe more interested in pressing the solution and putting it out than they were. And not necessarily for that. The young priest was a very nice fellow, and certainly not trying to manipulate people as best I could tell. Just sort of throwing up his hands, like, well, you know, people will just have these sort of things, and yeah. Oh well. So I went then and got a room for the night, and I'm gonna be staying. And I got a professional photographer with a telephoto lens, who actually was in the crowd and stuff, and I just sort of agreed to pay him if he'd shoot a roll of film for me, so that was easy. And when I went out to get the motel and have some food, I decided I needed a spotlight, just a good strong torch, and some binoculars, so I was able to pick those up. Those weren't in my investigative kit. And of course, at night, it's just parking lot lights and other ambient lights that were causing the effect. So the next morning, I'm back and I'm doing my final, you know, getting some more photos and writing up my notes and seeing if there's anybody I want to talk to and so forth. And this very nice lady comes by, church lady, and she says, "Well, Mr. Skeptic," or something like that, "what have you found?" Very cheerily. And so I explained it to her. And she smiled very sweetly and said, "Well, I prefer not to believe that." And walked off. It was like, oh, okay. You know? It's sort of sad in a way. It's funny in a way. But at least she was honest enough to say, well, I just choose to believe. It makes me feel good. And,
right.
And so it's not my job to wrestle her to the ground. But I do feel that I have a public mission to put out what I think is the true source of things. If I'm wrong, I hope people will, you know, challenge me, and we'll get to the truth somehow. Somewhat seriously and somewhat humorously, I don't care what they say about me. They can call me a fool or whatever. I just worry if they can prove it.
Right. Have you ever been stumped? Have you ever had like an inkling, but you can't quite find the evidence for it, and you're just you think maybe it's this, but you just can't prove it.
Oh, sure, that happens a lot. I could tell you stories of going down really false trails and so forth. It's usually a question, though, of getting good evidence. The Shroud of Turin, for example, skeptics are not really allowed to go examine it. And it's very difficult when you have multiple and contradictory reports making claims about the shroud, that if you accept one of those and you try this experiment and you can show how the forger might have made it, well, no, but that report's all wrong, and you'd have to follow this finding, and then and of course the findings are in contradiction of each other and so forth. The Shroud of Turin is extremely complicated because it was not properly investigated by a proper investigative group. Investigated by people who were scientists, yes, but many of them had no expertise whatsoever. Most of them, almost all of them, had no expertise in antiquities or detecting phony paintings or any artworks or anything of the sort that would have been relevant. And they were not only deeply devout Catholics, but worse than that, they were the leaders of that group were members of the Holy Shroud Guild. Mm. This is a little like saying, okay, boys and girls, let's explore the curvature of the earth. Is it round or is it flat? For this, let's go put together a team headed by the Flat Earth Society and we'll get to the bottom of this. Well,
major
that was a mistake.
Yeah.
And I don't always, I'm not always able to solve every mystery, but in most cases, the matter would not be admissible in court for lack of evidence. I don't have the evidence. If someone tells me, oh, it was back in 1966 and I was driving near Peoria and I saw an unidentified light in the sky and it was moving at an incredible speed, faster than any known craft, and it made a right angle turn, how do you explain that? And I would just say, I don't.
Mm-hmm.
I assume that you think it happened, or maybe it did happen, or I don't know. I don't know what you think you saw, but we get no further than just that's what's called anecdotal evidence. It's not admissible in court. So how could I be expected or have some burden to disprove something that I don't know even happened?
And yeah. There's
almost certainly some mistakes in there, perception and so forth. And I've certainly had cases like that. When to sum up, though, I would say that where I've had a fair chance to really get at the evidence and could, you know, do historical research if it was an old case, go back and so on, I've been able to find plausible explanations that in many cases would, to a reasonable person, using the principle of Occam's razor, that the simplest explanation is most likely correct. The one with the fewest assumptions. I've been able to propose a solution to cases and in some cases to even go further than that and find some corroborative evidence that not only is this the most likely explanation, here's some further evidence that it is indeed the correct one.
Mm-hmm.
And then there it stands unless some other piece of unforeseen data, some old document comes to light or something. It may cast things in a totally different light. You've thought someone mistakenly perceived something and you find an old document confessing it was a hoax. You should reopen the case and reassess all of this.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe to close out, is there a way for people to contact you if they have a mystery that they'd like you to investigate?
I don't solicit such things. I found that what that does is it brings out of the woodwork all sorts of, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but lonely people, people with neuroses, people trying to pull a hoax on me and mm-hmm. outdo me and so forth. So I don't take cases like that. I choose the cases. They don't.
Right.
And when people call, well, how do you know that my case isn't? I say, well, I don't, in the same way I don't know if that rock over there, if I turned it over, will have treasure under it. I have to operate on the basis that I look for the cases that have come my way because I see something myself. It may not be a big nationally known case or in the media, but it's come my way, and I've decided, as with the glowing statues at Campbell, Ohio, I had never heard of glowing statues before. Yes, many weeping statues and statues with heartbeats and moving statues and so on and on and on, but not glowing.
Mm-hmm.
So it intrigued me. Had someone called and said they had a glowing statue in their home, I probably just wouldn't do it because it's not high profile enough, and I would be so suspicious of their motives and so on. So I'm looking. I'm only able to do a few cases, and I choose.
Right.
It's my call. I do the ones that I want to, and of course, some cases get huge amounts of attention, and I pretty much have to look at them.
Right.
Want to or not.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Joe, thanks so much for joining us on Radio Free Thinker, and enjoy the rest of TAM.
Thanks for having me.
Are you a UBC student taking first-year economics, math, chemistry, or physics?
That stuff is hard.
Are you feeling like you need some tutoring? That's okay, because the AMS offers free and appointment tutoring for students in these subjects.
Whoa! How does it work?
It's on a first-come, first-served basis, and there's no need to sign up. Just show up with your books and your questions.
Whoa! When does it happen?
Monday to Thursday from 3 to 7 at the Sub Pacific Spirit Cafeteria, located beside the Starbucks.
Whoa! A plus, here I come.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So, in my travels on the internet newswire this week, I discovered the answer to one of man's ancient mysteries. The lifelong quest to discover which came first, the chicken or the egg.
I thought it was going to be why'd the chicken cross the road.
No, they're still working on that one. But before I get into it, does anyone have any theories?
Was it a prehistoric animal that was sort of a chicken, but kind of like a reptile or something?
My first instance is, like, I think the egg came first because eggs were around long before chickens.
Actually, this isn't taking it in an evolutionary angle. It's going, you know, chicken versus chicken egg. But basically, the thing that happened was a team, including a Dr. Colin Freeman from Sheffield University, collaborating with some Scottish scientists at Warwick University in Edinburgh, were basically investigating how egg formation works. And they were looking at chicken eggshells using some high-powered microscopes and analyzing the data with a supercomputer called Hector, which is stands for High-End Computing Terascale Resource. I think they really just wanted to call it Hector and came up with the words afterwards, but who doesn't do that? And what they found was that the eggshells need a certain catalyst in order to begin forming, a certain protein. And this protein, as far as we know, is only found in chickens. And so if you want to get eggs, you need a chicken, therefore definitively proving that the chicken has to come first.
But by that logic, that would have to mean somehow you'd have to have had something else have a chicken in it before. I'm still confused.
Chickens with live birth, to say nothing of the fact that there are, you know, creatures far older than a modern chicken that also laid eggs with hard shells. There's more than one way to accomplish this.
Yeah, saying that the egg formed in the chicken and you needed a chicken before the shell could form. Oh,
is really, really stupid, which I think is the takeaway that that every normal person gets from this story.
Well, what I want to know is who is the grant writing committee for this university? Someone, a paper comes onto your desk. We want to find out what came first, the chicken or the egg. Well, that's worth $25,000 right there.
I'm not sure that was the point. I think it was more about studying how egg formation works and using a supercomputer to analyze this kind of information.
You don't mean this isn't one of those stories where they've actually done some interesting biochemical research, and as a press story or something, they've spun it in this funny and humorous way.
My goodness, no, that never happens. Drunk Russians notwithstanding.
Yeah. Okay, well, it's always important to get the most up-to-date information on chicken egg embryo formation processes.
You know, and actually, to shift gears a little bit here, grants and getting money and all that. I understand we were talking before the show about how people in Louisiana are desperate to have some form of regulation to guarantee jobs or the environment. Which one was winning out there, jobs or the environment?
It was definitely jobs. I found about this in Miller and McCune article, and we'll put it up on the website radiofreethinker.com. Please check us out. According to a number of polls, and the one that was specifically cited in this article was one done by ABC News and the Washington Post, 79% of the people in the counties most affected by the BP oil spill call it a major disaster for the environment. 75% of them think it has hurt the local economy drastically. Even 33% of them are now actually clinically depressed because of the effects that the oil spill has had on their lives. Now, interestingly, in Louisiana, 72% of the poll population is completely against the 6-month ban on offshore drilling that the Obama administration has currently done and against further regulation on offshore drilling. Whereas the U.S. average, the entire U.S. average, is 39%. So that's a pretty huge difference.
Is this because, like the judge who struck down the first moratorium, that everyone in Louisiana owns stocks in BP and all that, Halliburton?
Yes, one of the main economic factors in Louisiana is oil drilling. What I thought was interesting here was that Miller McCune actually went on to look at some research into why this might be the case. And they cite an article in a journal called Rural Sociology, that's one of the most specialist journals I've ever heard of. But the article was called Place Effects on Environmental Views. And the hypothesis that these researchers were looking at was basically that the place you're in, the specific county and the location that you live in, will have a very large effect on your views on a number of political and economic topics, in this case on your environmental views. And they actually controlled a lot of other factors, age, income, all sorts of things that you might think would have more of an impact, but they found that location had the most impact out of all of them. And specifically, the one factor that had the huge, huge impact that is being felt in Louisiana is unemployment. So when people want jobs, and when the major economy locally is based on something that is like oil drilling, then no amount of environmental damage is going to convince you to change your mind that keeping oil drilling going and as unregulated as possible so that you can keep working is going to change your mind.
Well, and this is amplified too, because this particular effect is I was listening to one of my podcasts that said there are three major industries in Louisiana, fishing, tourism, and the oil industry. And the oil industry has essentially eliminated any competition it had as a viable industry, so everyone there is desperate for the only jobs in town, which would be oil jobs.
So as always, these things are context specific, and in this case, the location that you're in has a large effect on your views because of what it makes available to you.
Doesn't this seem to be a bit more of the sort of chicken and egg question in a way? Because, I mean, to sit there and say that, well, people whose jobs are affected are more likely to be in favor of whatever it is that is their job, I mean, it seems on one level to be kind of, obvious. So, for example, people in Sault Ste. Marie or Kitchener that have a lot of auto jobs, to sit there and say, well, they would be in favor of the auto industry, again, somehow just seems to be...
Well, to you, I put forth the concept of hindsight bias, which is something that cognitive psychologists have studied, namely that the results of any particular study or that some piece of advice someone tells you seems obvious, but only in hindsight. The point of this study, from what I understand of it, was not that... people whose livelihoods depend on oil drilling are in favor of less regulation of oil drilling, but that the factor of unemployment and local economy had much more of an impact on their environmental views than any number of other factors that you might think also had a large impact.
Actually, I was hoping you were going to go the other direction, sorry. Because a lot of people will sit there and say, well, the people who really know it best are the people who are in it. So when it comes to regulating the oil industry, who better knows what regulations are needed than those in the industry? The whole idea of industry self-regulating, and I was kind of, but you didn't, but we're running out of time.
That's a topic for another show.
Well, why don't we go to our skeptical highlights to close the show out. And like always, my skeptical highlight is coming up on July 30th when we have the, well, on strike blogger P.Z. Myers, the author of Pharyngula, will be here in Vancouver to give two talks, one in Abbotsford, one in Vancouver. I encourage you to come to both. You can check out www.cficanada.ca/Vancouver for all your ticket information.
And if you're listening live, come join us after the show. Tonight on Tuesday is Skeptics in the Pub downtown at the Railway Club.
And I have a quick one, just Quest of Origins, which is a planetarium show about the Big Bang and the universe being put on at the Macmillan Science Center, which I think is just by Burrard Bridge.
Sure.
My highlight is coming up in 3 days. I'm going to be in Columbus, Ohio for the Secular Student Alliance conference. It promises to be very exciting and productive.
Well, I hope bring us back a report from that.
Yes. Well, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver, saying thanks for listening.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Rob saying thank you to Jacob for being our guest on this show. And to our listeners, have a good evening.
So long, everybody.